And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus, and we're streaming live at KUCI.org. This morning I'm sitting in for Ryan Folan, host of 313. He'll be back next week. So Writers on Writing gets to have a doubleheader today, and this first Wednesday, this first day of the show after New Year's. Happy New Year, 2019. Hi, here we go. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we have a doubleheader, as I said. For the first hour, I'm with memoirist Beth Howard, author of Hausfrau Honeymoon and Making Peace. And at 9, I'll bring on actor Omid Abtahi. First, Beth Howard. She's the author of Making Peace, a memoir of love, loss, and pie, and Miss American Pie, Buttery Good Recipes and Bold Tales from the American Gothic House. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Real Simple, and Country Living, among many other publications. She's been on CNN, CBS, This Morning, NPR, and of course, Writers on Writing. And she's here today to talk about Hausfrau Honeymoon, Love, Language, and Other Misadventures in Germany. Hey, Beth.
Hi, Barbara.
There you are.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Of course. Of course. It was great seeing you when you were out here. And some of what we talk about might be a little repetitious for us, but not for our listeners. So this is going to be fun. I'm just so happy to talk to you on the air again. You were on for Making Peace, and that was a couple years ago. When was that?
That was 2012.
Oh, gosh. My goodness.
Time is flying.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, let's talk about Hausfrau Honeymoon to begin with, and it's a prequel to Making Peace.
That's right. I wrote this about 15. I started it 15 years ago and finished it 12 years ago, and then it just sat around. And in the meantime, you know, life got away from me, and lots of things happened, and I wrote about those other things in Making Peace and so on. But this was when I first fell in love with Marcus, my late husband, and about our courtship and about moving to Germany for love, and thinking, oh, how hard could it be? I've traveled the world, and living in Germany, it's Western Europe, and turned out it was pretty hard. And in fact, it was so difficult, I started writing down all these crazy stories of all the things that happened while I was trying to adjust to living in this new country and being newly married also at 40. So I had a lot of things to get off my chest, and writing is just such great therapy. It was a good way to deal with all of the I guess you could say frustrations, but also adventures.
Yeah. So are you always keeping a journal? I mean, you had so many specifics in this book, just so very many. And, you know, that's always a question, I think, or a wonder with memoirists, is how are you remembering all this?
Here's a conversation I had with you a long time ago. And I remember telling you, I blog, you know, like I write about this stuff in essays in sort of real time. And you were like, yeah, but you're giving all your stuff away. Aren't you supposed to, you know, save that and not, not put it out there until you're ready to publish your book? And I'm like, no, I don't. That is actually what happened for me. Is for this particular book, I wasn't blogging about it, but I was writing essays about it and sending them to my friends. It was sort of blogosphere, but that kind of thing of just writing in real time, writing down the stories as they happened, writing them as essays to share. You know, I don't know if I was trying to get them published anywhere, but I definitely was sharing them with friends. And I think maybe in the back of my mind, I had an idea that that was something that could make a book at some point. But, you know, it takes a while to collect all those essays, accumulate all the material, so you kind of have to live through it. But I think just knowing in the back of my mind that I wanted to turn something into a book eventually, I wrote in real time as things happened and put them in sort of essay format as they happened. So the book was already sort of written, if you will, by the time I was ready to put it all together. I just had to take all these essays and then create transitions to piece them together into an actual narrative.
So one thing about you and about your writing that I've said before, and I'll say it again, is what I think all memoirists could learn from, which is that you are sort of unabashedly honest and revealing about yourself. And I think that's really, really hard for memoirists and even essayists to actually do. And it seems that's how you live your life. And I'm thinking more and more, I'm thinking that memoirists are writers who kind of, you know, live their life honestly and live their life on the page honestly. Do you think of yourself that way?
I do think of myself as very open, and I feel like when we share our stories, then we help each other feel less alone in this world. You know, if you tell something very revealing about yourself that allows somebody else to come forward and say, oh, I'm so glad you said that because that's the same thing is happening with me, but I never had anyone to talk about it to, or I never knew that I was the only one that felt like that. And, you know, it's helpful. I think it's a gift to the world to share our stories and to be honest, because we're all in this crazy humanity ship together, you know. It's like we don't know what it all means. We're all trying to make sense of it. We're all struggling. Every one of us struggles. You know, if we can't just share those struggles to help each other feel more connected and less alone, then what's the point of being here, really? That's kind of how I feel. I feel like I have nothing to hide. I don't want to have anything to hide. I don't want to live that way.
So has it always been nonfiction?
Yes, and I think about that a lot lately because I'm thinking about a next book, and I'm like, God, I don't know. Should I turn it into fiction? You know, I'm just like, I'm terrified of fiction. I don't even know how to write fiction. I feel like I would come across as a fraud because no one would believe these made-up stories, you know, least of all myself. But I'm thinking, you know, like I always remember Jeanette Walls, after she wrote The Glass Castle, she had a follow-up book, and I remember her saying, she made it sort of a hybrid fiction, nonfiction, because she couldn't remember all the dialogue so exactly, so she didn't want to present it as a memoir. And I think fictionalized nonfiction is, you know, I suppose that's a way to do it, by being able to create more drama, take more creative license, and especially, like, I still want to write about my trip I did around the world in 2015, and I was so maxed out while I was traveling, I didn't have any time to write down the stories, even to keep a journal, so I don't have all of the facts, and my memory is just not that great. So what I was able to do with Hausfrau Honeymoon and Making Peace was all fine because I wrote that down as it was happening, but with my trip around the world, I'm like, oh, I might have to fictionalize that, you know, because I just don't have enough material, like, in my journal or in the essays that I would have liked to have written, or blog posts.
Well, it used to be, and years ago, you know, Romana Clef, that was, you know, writers, Hemingway, all those guys and girls and everybody, they took their lives and fictionalized them, and we weren't so locked into categories back then either. I mean, now, you know, now what shelf does it go on? But back then it was literature, it was books. And I wonder if part of that is just being locked into the category, you know, like if you forgot about the category, what would come out? What would you write? Do you know?
I don't know. I'm still toying with that. Like, one of the things that was really frustrating about Making Peace is it got categorized as a food memoir, just to your point, right? But to me, it was a grief memoir.
Right.
And I feel like it did a disservice to the people who could really benefit from the story about my journey through grief and how I made pie to help overcome that, and, or, you know, at least to get through it. You never really overcome. But, you know, those people that would benefit the most from a story like that would be probably looking in the grief section, not the food section, right? Yeah, that is definitely a frustration of being an author these days, and they only give you one choice.
Yeah.
Like, and then it's not up to the author either, by the way. So it's also frustrating. But I don't know, would that make a difference? I don't know. I think I just read it like 12 years ago, and I just reread it, in fact, a couple of days ago, The True and Outstanding Adventures of the Hunt Sisters by Elizabeth Robinson. Do you know that book?
I know it. I haven't read it, but yeah.
It's one of my favorite books. It's an epistolary, so she's writing letters. All the letters are from her to various characters in the story. And I know for a fact it is based very much on her real-life story, but again, you know, she took some creative license and embellished and created drama, I suppose. I mean, I don't know how much of it is fictionalized, and I guess that's the question. But, you know, I guess that's the format that I'm sort of dreaming about at the moment. I keep coming back to it. The word epistolary keeps coming up, and mm-hmm. I keep finding these movies and books and things of that with that theme. I go, okay, so I'm gravitating toward that. I haven't actually sat down to try to write it that way yet, but, you know, where do you categorize a book like that? You know, again, it's probably going to have to be fiction.
Right. Have you read 84 Charing Cross Road?
Oh, it's one of the things I was just referring to.
Oh, I love that book.
That I just keep coming back to, these things keep popping up in my life, these epistolary versions. So, and I remember when Elizabeth Robinson wrote, when she wrote The True and Outstanding Adventures of the Hunt Sister, her editor did not think it was a good idea to do that format. But she insisted, and it worked out beautifully. So, but yeah, 84 Charing Cross Road, I actually was just looking at the movie trailer for it with Anne mm-hmm. Bancroft and
right.
Anthony Hopkins. I was like, I think I'll just watch it because I didn't have the book handy. So I'm like, maybe I'll just watch it. And I will
yeah.
do that tonight, probably.
Yeah, actually, I love the movie and I love the book. And the book is so thin, you know, you can read it in a day, probably. And I just loved it. And I love that form, too. And I mean, with that, you know, I think it is basically, you know, what happened between her and a bookseller. But, you know, there has to be fiction in there. You know, there's,
right.
You know,
there has to be. Yeah.
And
so.
There was another one, 2 years ago that I always have remembered. It was Joanna's husband, David's wife. And it was categorized as a novel, but it's all letters. It's letters from her to him and him to her, and sort of their life unfolds via letters. And I love that.
All right. I'm going to write that down and look it up.
Yeah.
Wait, tell me again, Joanna's...
Joanna's husband, David's wife.
David's wife.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's fun to explore something new. And for me, I want to kind of create a new challenge. I think that's what's important to me, is always stretching and growing. Not just as a writer, as a person, you know, but in terms of my publishing background, like I did one memoir, I did one cookbook, and then I did the House for a Honeymoon memoir. I self-published it, so that was a whole learning curve. And then maybe for the next one, then I do the epistolary fiction. Oh my God, that would be new and different. And again, something that would allow me to grow as a writer.
Well, and, you know, with House for a Honeymoon as well as Making Peace, they're both memoirs that have, you know, dramatic arc. They have, you know, this forward momentum that, you know, a beginning, a middle, and an end. And, you know, memoir and novels, I mean, they're just such similar forms. One happened, one didn't. Or
well,
who knows
whether
one did.
What I've always learned in writing workshops about nonfiction, about memoir, is they have to read like a novel.
Yeah.
That's otherwise you can just forget it.
Yeah.
Right? Forget publishing it. It has to have that kind of an arc. And I know that I'm so familiar with that format from writing essays, having a beginning, middle, and end, you know, in particular a conclusion, you know, like what did you learn from, what was the takeaway from this whole drama and this whole journey? And so just, you know, sort of expanding that, stretching it out to be a full-length work isn't really that much different than writing just a short essay. And then as Mary Roach, the author, I heard her speak once, she was so daunted by writing her first book, and her friend told her, just think of it as a bunch of magazine articles stuck
right.
between two covers.
Right.
That was like, that always stuck with me too. It's like, okay, it's just a bunch of essays stuck between two covers. So, you know, just take on the little bit at a time, and pretty soon you'll have enough material for a full book length.
And
project.
Plus, you're just such a natural writer and so prolific that I can't imagine once you got into it that you wouldn't have a good time of it, you know? I don't know.
Yeah.
Interesting to see what you do.
I'm interested too. I was just writing in my journal this morning going, what's the goal for the year? What's, you know, am I going to do a new book or not? And I just tell myself, don't put pressure on yourself. You know, I have to trust my track record that when I latch on to an idea, I just go for it, you know, if it's the right idea, you know, it'll take on a life of its own, and I shouldn't worry about that because I've produced books before. I will certainly do it again. I keep thinking about it, so that must be what I want to do, and when the time is right, when I finally get my desk cleaned off, which I'm still working on, I was supposed to do that during the holidays, and then, you know, like, we just had all this socializing, and I never got around to actually doing the house clearing, desk purging project that I needed to do to start fresh on the new year. But I did just purchase a new computer monitor, so I'm very excited, like, to like have the tools to, you know, I'm investing in the tools to move forward and work on my next project.
Well, all of you out there, you are listening to Writers on Writing, our double header show. We've never done this before, so it's kind of fun. And
I hope you have coffee to keep yourself going.
I do. It's on the floor, actually. We cannot have coffee up here on the board because one spill and it's all over. So I have this covered container on the floor that I have to reach for and bend over and sip from whenever I want some. So I'm talking with Beth Howard. Her new book is Hausfrau Honeymoon, Love, Language, and Other Misadventures in Germany. And I should say before we go on that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are not those of the University of California Regents, but they're my views and Beth's views, our opinions, and we're responsible for them, okay? Not the university. Anyway, can you read? Will you read from the book?
Oh, my gosh.
Do you
All
have
right.
it?
Well,
right
you want there? Me to just open up a random page?
Sure.
And start?
Or
I just,
start at the beginning. The beginning
here,
is
okay,
a good
well,
place,
look at,
too.
We were just talking about coffee.
Okay.
So, here. Frau Koch brings out a fresh pot of coffee. She wears a white apron and holds the pot handle loosely to protect her red-painted fingernails. Frau Eisen, der zweite Pfirschkuchen braucht noch ein paar Minuten, she says to Marcus's mother, explaining that the second peach cake needs a few more minutes in the oven. Danke, Frau Koch, Andrea replies. Sie können gehen werden. Oh, my God, I have German so terrible, embarrassed to read it over the radio. And tells her the formal Sie. She can leave when it's done. You need to stay on Sie terms with Frau Koch, Marcus has instructed me more than once on how to address his parents' housekeeper. She'll try to speak to you using Du. She always tries to get close, he says, as if being close is not a welcome thing. Frau Koch is like a favorite aunt. Gifts from her fill our apartment, jars of her homemade jam and her hand-knit wool socks. She never misses sending us a birthday or holiday card. On the occasions I have encountered her in the kitchen peeling carrots and potatoes or polishing silver for Wolfgang and Andrea, or Frau and Herr Eisen, as she is required to call them after 8 years of employment in their home, Frau Koch asks me, "How are you doing? Are you making some friends? Are you happy here?" And every time I see her, she offers me encouragement, which I am badly in need of. Your German is getting really good. It's improving. I could never speak English as well as you speak German, she says. Thanks, I say, and not thank you, as to avoid the Z versus do issue. The coffee cups are refilled. The family dialogue continues. From what I can make out, Marcus explains what's new at the car company. Wolfgang gives an update on the Autobahn construction near their house. And Andrea offers her opinions, her disapproval, on how Marcus's cousins are raising their children, while avoiding any mention about us giving her grandchildren. Anybody got a good fart joke, I want to ask? Want me to keep going?
Yeah, go on a little bit more.
One more, okay. Sipping my sixth cup of coffee out of the antique gold-trimmed china cup, dishes clank in the kitchen as Frau Koch unloads the dishwasher. I shift my butt in the chair. If only I could leave the table and go practice my German with her. She could correct my grammar and laugh her raspy cigarette laugh as I relay my stories about Munich. I would ask her for her jam recipe. I would ask her what her first name is, and I would most definitely address her with Du. Instead, I stay seated in my straight-backed, silk-covered chair and pick at the remaining crumbs of my cake with my silver fork. Marcus reaches his hand over and rubs my neck. My parents have invited us to stay for Abendbrot, he whispers. I anticipate Andrea's usual cold dinners of bologna salad, fine strips of bologna marinated in vinegar, served with tomato slices and buttered wheat bread. It is these meals that make me long to be married to an Italian. I also know from experience that once dinner is over, Wolfgang will break out a few bottles of his homemade schnapps, wanting us to sample his pear, wild berry, forest herb, or whatever new infusion he is experimenting with. The German distilled spirit is served in small portions as a digestive, but it's potent and much too strong for me. I will take a tiny sip of each and offer to drive back to Stuttgart so Marcus can enjoy drinking with his dad. Even the most casual of dinners with the Eisens will be, at the shortest, a three-hour affair. Nonetheless, I whisper back, "Oh, okay, sure." I muster a smile for Marcus while inside my head I begin to hum the words, "You're so brave. You can do it. You're so brave." That's the end of chapter seven.
That's great. Thank you. That was Beth Howard reading from Hausfrau Honeymoon. So, you know, as you were reading and as I was reading the book, it's something I think about all the time, and I'm always talking to memoirists about, because students of memoir worry about those who are going to read the book, or worry about relatives, friends, family, that they are, something's going on with one of these machines there, that, you know, they're going to read and react. And do you do that? Do you worry about how people are going to react as you're writing, or at any point in the process?
That is an excellent question. And for starters, I will tell you that I am not in contact with Marcus's parents, and I did change their name. So, but, you know, thin disguise, because you can Google Marcus's name, or you can Google me and find out his, you know, all the information you ever wanted to know. But anyway, I'm not in contact with them. His cousins read this book, and I was like, oh, my God, I never even considered that they would be reading this book, because they're in Germany, you know, and this book is in English, it's published in America. And so, yeah, when I got the email, oh, we read your book, and she said, it's kind of funny to read about my cousin's private life, you know, but she goes, but I really like it. So it was such a relief, you know. So I think I had enough, I've had enough support from the people who've liked my writing to get past the people who perhaps, for example, my mother. Uh-huh. Sorry, I don't know who's listening to this, but I write a lot about my mom in my books, and I kind of oftentimes make her out to be a bit of an antagonist, because, you know, we need to create drama in our stories, and we all have drama in our lives. It is real life, but she doesn't read my stuff. So I guess that sort of takes the pressure off of that. I try to be nice. You know, I was raised by parents who said, if you can't say something nice, don't say it at all.
Mm-hmm.
So in my books, you know, I'm not being so mean that you would disown me or you would sue me. You know, I don't think I do anything that extreme. And also, I don't have the kind of extreme dysfunction in my life where I would be in any kind of, I think, danger or endanger anybody's lives or have somebody go to jail because of what I wrote. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think there's anything that extreme to really worry too much about it in terms of what I write. But I did write my memoir, which is still in manuscript phase. It hasn't been published yet, but my memoir about living in the American Gothic house, you know, in southern Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I did try to get an agent a few years ago when I first started working on it, and they said, the agents were the ones that say, we can't publish this because it's a small town, and even if you changed people's names, everybody will still know who everybody is.
But
so
was that a worry, though?
Pardon me?
I said, why was that a worry? I mean, memoir is, you're supposed to name names. You're supposed to.
Well, in that case, there were some people that were really some unsavory characters, I guess you could say. I don't know. Maybe because it made them look bad, and maybe it was just the way I wrote it. Maybe I wasn't ready to tell the story yet, and so I wasn't able to sort of make fun of myself, because I think that's the part about Hausfrau Honeymoon that makes people like it, is that you can see that I am like, you know, I'm not happy there, and I'm, you know, making digs at the people there, but I'm also the one that's just a total train wreck, you know? It's me, the one that you can really laugh at, I think. So, you know, and just the mishaps, but with the American Gothic House memoir, I'm just not really sure yet where it stands. But I went back like 2 years later and did a major overhaul to try to make people funny and try to make myself. I tried to own more of the ridiculousness of things that happened there. So I don't know. That book is still out there, sort of floundering, and has not taken on its published form yet. So we'll see how it all turns out. But that's an example of being a bit stifled by having to be a lot more careful about what I say about people.
Right. And see if that was fiction, you know?
I know. And I'm still thinking about that. I think that's going to be one of my projects this year before I can even start on the next book, is to take that American Gothic House memoir and maybe do another rewrite on it or something. I don't know. That's daunting. I hate rewriting. I like to just get on with it, get on with the next book, keep moving forward. But unfortunately, you know, sometimes you do really have to go back. And then, you know, every author you hear says, Maybe they get so frustrated having to rewrite something so many times. Their editor tells them they have to redo the whole thing. You know, they get frustrated. But how many times do you hear them say that? They're so glad they did.
Right.
Oh, my book is so much better for it, you know. So
right.
I think I need a good editor to step in and give me the smackdown and say, here's what I think you could do or try to do, because I'm too close to that project, I think, at this point. So.
Have you tried just writing it again, not looking at the old version?
I think I'm already on my second full. I've already done a second full rewrite. I'm like, oh no, I don't know. Maybe I just need to let it sit there in the drawer. Stephen King, you know, puts his stuff away, right? Don't you? What's his book called? On Writing.
Yeah.
That was called. Yeah.
Well. Yeah.
So doesn't he say that? You know, just put that thing away and walk away from it and go work on something else.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe someday I'll come back to it. I don't know.
So how do you deal with deadlines then when you don't have an external deadline? You know, it's like there's a project you want to work on, whether it's that book, a book, an essay, and there's nobody, you know, breathing down your neck. There's not an editor waiting for it, but it's something you want to work on. How do you structure your days so that you get that piece written, you know, in a timely fashion instead of, you know, I want to write it and it's done next year?
I think. Because once I start on a project, once I decide, I think that's what when I hear so many people say, I want to write a book, but then they won't keep their butt in the chair, right? I'm like, you have to decide. You have to decide you want to do it badly enough that you're willing to keep your butt in the chair. And I also think momentum is really helpful. Like, once I get going, and then it's like, okay, I'm on my way. I want to get there now. I want to reach my destination. So once I'm on the road, I want to keep going. And the other thing, using that analogy, is having a roadmap. I sat down with there's a screenwriter, Alex Dinalaris, and he wasn't famous like he is now. He wrote Birdman, Oscar winning. You know, like, mm-hmm. He wasn't famous when I met him back in 2006. I took a writing workshop in New York City, and he was a guest speaker. And I had a chance to sit down alone with him, and this was when I was working on House Row Honeymoon. And he helped me come up with the structure, with it's basic outline. All he did was go, and then what happened? And then what happened?
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened? And I was like, okay, so I was telling him my story over coffee, and that was as simple as that. It's like I put together a list of chapters in chronological order, but, you know, you can do that. You can have this roadmap where you write in chronological order, but you digress in between, and that's a technique that just comes naturally. It happens just in normal conversation where you're going one direction, but then, oh, but then let me tell you about this and fill in the backstory. And then you keep going, and then you, oh, wait, but let me fill in this backstory too. So you know what I mean? You're moving forward chronologically, but you dip back in time every so often.
Yeah, you know,
story.
I like that about A House for a Honeymoon, that yeah, we have you in current time and then we have you in the past. And I just love that structure. I love that structure.
But that just seems like it comes naturally, you know, because that's how we talk.
Right.
In conversation. We fill in the backstory. So, but to your other question about how do you finish, how do you get to the deadlines, I think it's just because I have an outline of a book. I have my list of chapters, you know, so I know where I'm starting and I pretty much know where I'm going to end. And then once I get started, I'm like, I just want to finish it. You know, I really just want to finish it. And I also have a short attention span. And when I say short, it's like 3 months. Like, I work really well in 3 month increments. So
really?
I like to feel like it takes, you know, 3 months to crank out a draft.
Wow.
That's
working a lot.
Okay, but let me tell you, your friend Sam Dunn, who is in Irvine, right?
Mm-hmm.
She told me once that when she was writing her memoir, she would stay in her bathrobe for 6 weeks, not leave the house, and just, you know, get it down. And I love that. I think mm-hmm. about that still. She doesn't even probably, she has probably no idea that I still think about her that much and that how I think about what she said about how, you know, you buckle down and do it. Don't get out of the chair.
Yeah.
Until you get it done. And I just go, okay, I can do that for a short period of time. I can't do that for a whole year. I can do it for a month or 3 months, but I cannot do it much longer. Like with, when I went back to do Hausfrau, for example, well, okay, let's go back to Making Peace. When I wrote Making okay. Peace, I had a bunch of the essays and some blog posts, and I still had a lot of material that I still had to write, but at least I had a, and I had written my little roadmap, you know, my day, where it's going. And some days it was really easy to stay in the chair, and some days it was really, really hard to stay in the chair. But I wanted to get it done. And in that case, I actually did end up with a deadline. And I did have an agent and a publisher who, you know, that did help push me along. But just get started, you know, decide you want to do it. That would be my best advice to anybody.
Well, we talked about this when I saw you a couple weeks ago about how, you know, the proliferation of MFA programs and other programs to get people writing, you know, why aren't writers writing without the programs, right? I mean, you know, where do we find that discipline without being in a structure?
And for me, it was a blog.
Right.
And I don't know if it's even, like, I think you just have to want to do it. I think writing is a calling. You know, my boyfriend and I read something, and we couldn't find the article. We were talking about it again last night. We went through the recycle pile of Time, all the Time magazines for the last month, and we're like, where did we read that? But it was some guy, a writer, and I'm sorry I can't remember who said it, but what he said was just so simple. And he goes, talking about writing is not writing. Like, yeah, okay. I think it's a calling. I think you have to just really want to do it. I think people have this sort of idea about it, this romantic notion about it. But, you know, it's work. It takes work. It, you know, takes discipline to sit in the chair. It just takes, like, also, it takes wrangling your self-doubt. And I think that's why MFA programs are so popular, is because people just don't have the confidence in themselves. You know, they have too much doubt, so they need to go, you know, shore themselves up, and that's fine. I think, you know, I think there's something to be said for taking a workshop here and there, and, you know, and honing your craft. But for me, I think blogging has been the most helpful thing, because it gives me a chance to write, and I love the satisfaction of pushing the publish button. You know, like, that mm-hmm. is instant gratification for me. I'm published. Look, I put the button myself. I put my blog out there. You know, it's usually I take the time to craft a thought out essay. And the beautiful thing about the blog is you get feedback. You get instant feedback. And you know if people like your stuff or not. And people give you comments. And to me, that's really helpful for writing, to encourage you to keep going. When you start building a following, I think that's incredibly helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, you lived in LA for quite a while, and you moved to Iowa.
Yes.
So talk about that. How does Iowa serve you creatively?
There's nothing else to do here.
No, you're on a farm. There's lots of farm stuff.
I also tell people, like, one of the ways to be a writer is take the financial pressure off yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't have the responsibilities and pressures that a lot of people do. I don't have kids. You know, I don't have a full-time job. I don't have any job. You know, my job, I tell myself, is writing, even though it's like, it's not a great living, but, you know, but my overhead is so tremendously low that I don't have any financial pressure to do anything else at this point in my life. And I'm 56, you know, I'm like, I've already had a lot of careers. I've logged a lot of office hours. I've done a lot of office politics. I'm not interested in that anymore. You know, so part of, you know, that comes with age, kind of wanting to just sort of dip out of all the rat race. But I live in a farmhouse on 1,000 acres, and it's so quiet, and I have, my office is really cute when my desk is not a nightmare like it is right now. And, you know, I'm close to nature. I think that's one of the things that's really helpful too in terms of my writing space, is I can write all day and then go outside and go for a nice long walk across the fields, and we have trails through the woods, and go for a run on the gravel roads or bike ride. And, you know, there's just a lot of space. And I do a lot of writing in my head when I'm out walking. That's when I come up with a lot of my best ideas. Like a story will take shape in my head, and I have to practically run back to my desk to write it down, you know. But I know it's something I really must write if I'm out there walking and walking, and like it's like a moving meditation, and that's when you sort of just get away from the computer. Sometimes that's when my best writing happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. There's something, and it's certainly been written about quite a lot about walking and how that helps you generate ideas and get to a creative spot within yourself. Mm-hmm. But I find that too, you know, I just being out there, there's something that happens that, you know, something comes to mind and you go, oh, yeah, this is what I have to do, which wasn't happening in the house, right?
Right. You have to give yourself that space. And this is what I think we should both be spreading this message, Barbara, because all these writing programs, a lot of them, you know, will tell you, you have to stay in the chair and look at the blank screen and, you know, you have to stay there, you have to force it. I'm like, you know what? If it's not coming to you, go for a walk.
Yeah.
You know, don't sit there at your computer at the blank screen. And plus, you have to, you know, you go out and maybe you'll be inspired. You see a bird fly by and that triggers some idea, and then you can go back to the computer with a fresh, you know, fresh energy. But I guess this idea that you have to sit in front of a blank screen is crazy. And I mean, yes, you have to sit in the chair to get all your words down, but I also think there's a balance that you have to get out there and let your mind settle. And like my best walks are the ones after a full day of writing, and I can go over in my head what I've just written. It's like kind of like mull it over and go, is that right? Did I get, you know, mm-hmm. So it's really helpful to kind of just distill what I've just worked on. It's just my own pattern. Like, you know, it's different for everyone, but I really do encourage people to just get out and not always have to be in front of the computer, because that's not where all the best writing happens.
And you know, you look at the anatomy of the body and physiology, and the body was made to move, and it wasn't made to sit in one spot for mm-hmm. hours on end. And when we do that, I think, I don't know, for me, things...
Stagnant energy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
What I do also is, it was Anne Lamott or somebody said, you know, they always, always, always have a notebook with them, you know, like hanging around their neck or something. What for me, yeah, I have my iPhone, so I dictate into my phone when I'm out riding my bike or walking. You know, when these ideas come, I'm like, oh my God, I have to remember that. I don't have a notebook, but I will just quickly dictate something. And then I can even dictate full paragraphs of, mm-hmm. you know, something. So that's a little tool that I use.
You know, something I do this regularly, but now I'm doing it with a typewriter because I love typewriters and I like to work on early drafts on typewriters, but I work backwards. So if I know I have a deadline, I have a short story contest deadline at the end of January. And so a few days ago I said, okay, it's not January yet. I got to start this because I'm not going to write it in the last week because then it's going to be lousy because there'll be no time to go over it, no time to let it sit. And I'll just work backwards because I notice that, at least in my classes, some writers will wait until like, you know, a few days before they're up for critique and do their piece then. And inevitably, it just doesn't work. You know, I mean, they might have, you know, great stuff for a future draft, but... You know, just letting your deadlines go and not, you know, not thinking about them and how you're going to get to that point.
You don't want the pressure. In other words, you want to work.
Yeah, I mean,
the deadline looming.
Right. I mean, you know, the deadline's there, but I know I have to let my stuff sit for a while. And if I don't have that cushion, then, you know, waiting to the last minute is not going to work. It's just not going to work for me. But also,
I always marvel at people like columnists for newspapers, or is that still such a thing? You know, but people who have columns who have to crank out the stuff day after day, and they don't have that luxury of, you know, getting it done ahead of time and waiting. And I don't know. That's to me just something I really admire. Like, I don't know if I could keep up that momentum or that, you know, the consistency of it.
Right. But something you said earlier, too, about overhead, and I don't know who said this years ago. I remember reading someone said, keep your overhead low. And, you know, what great advice, because, you know, as writers, when you have all sorts of financial obligations, you know, you want to buy the new car, you want to buy the new house, you want to, whatever it is, kind of, you know, jams in the writing space, right?
Right. My car is 10 years old, and it's a Mini Cooper, and I love it so much. I don't, you know, I don't want to let go of that car. Plus, Marcus bought me that car, so it's oh my God, if anything ever happens to that car. But, you know, I don't have any car payments. That's my point.
Right.
You know, so those are the things. Like, I don't need a new car. I hear what you're saying. And I don't need a lot of clothes. I live on the farm. All I ever wear is overalls.
I saw you,
actually,
looked...
all I ever wear is my pajamas because I don't usually have to get dressed.
Well,
I'll just put the overalls on over my pajamas.
When
it's
I saw
sad.
You, when you were down here a couple weeks ago, I saw you and you were looking very cute, and you weren't in pajamas and you weren't in overalls. You had a cute skirt. You're very cute.
I have a policy that when I leave the farm, I'm not allowed to wear my overalls.
No.
I have to, like, make an effort. And, you know, I'm only an hour and 10 minutes south of Iowa City, which is a UNESCO City of Literature. You would think that would be having some great influence on my writing life here, but actually I have nothing, you know, it has no influence. The best part about Iowa City is it has Trader Joe's, so I can go stock up on wine. But, you know, but my point is, yeah, I do get dressed and go out once in a while. And I do wish that we had more, like, coffee houses nearby where I could just take my laptop and go be around noise and be around other creative types sitting around. But there's not a lot of opportunity for that here either. So just sit in my overalls.
Is there a period of time that works best for you to get writing done? Are you a writer that needs to get it done first thing?
No. I have a routine. I get up. I have to feed the goats and walk the dogs, and I have to have my latte. I've got a really nice little espresso machine. And then at 10 o'clock, it's like clockwork. It's like a built-in biological clock that by 10 o'clock, I am at my desk. So I start at 10 a.m. And if I haven't gotten dressed all day, by the way, that means I've had a super productive day. Too busy to get dressed, you know? So those are good days. Write till 6 or 7 o'clock if I can. But I'm in a relationship, and, you know, we like to have dinner together, so that's sort of altered my writing flow a little bit. But I do try to just pack in as much as I can between 10 and 5, I guess.
Do you share your early work? Do you share it with your boyfriend?
I like to, but he falls asleep when I read to him. So he's not a very good audience. I mean, but he does have good editing advice when I can catch him at a good point. But I haven't done that for a while. But I was doing that with my American Gothic House work. He was so familiar with the story, and so he was good for listening to that. But we stopped doing that. I don't know what happened. But I mean, if anything, just blogging, you know, sharing and work through my blog. And I don't know. I guess it depends on if I get to a certain point where I'm trying to prepare something for a proposal, then I really share my work. Like,
mm-hmm.
I vet that with maybe 5 or 6 writer friends who I really trust, who will give me not just, oh, it's great, but, I really think that, you know, your character needs to be, or, you know, character being me.
Right.
I actually had somebody on Housefrau Honeymoon say, Marcus isn't very likable, and, oh, you're not very likable either. And I was like, oh, ouch, you know. So, I do share my work when it's time to go really public with it, like when it's time to publish. Before it's time to publish, I definitely vet my work then.
Mm. What about social media? What's your relationship with Facebook, Twitter?
I don't like the pressure, you know, and publishers and agents and everything, you have to have a social media presence, you have to have a platform, and I rebel against that sometimes because it's just too much. I'm like, hey, it didn't used to be like this, you know, in the old days, and the old famous authors, you know, so much has changed where you have to be famous, you know. It's like, you have to have 20, what did I read the other day? Publishers want to know that they'll be able to sell 20,000 books straight out the gate.
Yeah.
So you have to have some, you know, mega following. And I just go, that I am not interested in being a Kardashian or whatever. Like, that whole thing makes me really a little crazy. And so I just try to stay my own course. I, you know, I have my main Facebook page is called The World Needs More Pie, and that tied in with making peace and my, you know, Ms. American Pie cookbook and my days living in the American Gothic house and running the Pitchfork pie stand. You know, of course, that became this whole brand. But, you know, I'm kind of moving beyond that now, too. So I don't update the way I used to, and I'm not making pie the way I used to, and I'm not teaching pie classes the way I was. So I don't have as much to put out there except for, oh, hey, I'm going to be on Barbara DeMarco Barrett's radio show, you know, and then it becomes like, I don't want to brag. I don't want to be that person right out there going, look at me, look at me.
Right.
So it's I have an uncomfortable relationship with social media, and yet I find Facebook tremendously helpful in terms of connecting with people.
Mm-hmm.
Like just having a network, having a support system. There's, you know, for journalism, for writing, there are these groups, women's groups, binders mm-hmm. groups, they call them,
yep.
People are so generous and supportive. And there's, you know, I've made a lot of friends, people who I met through Facebook that have become good friends. So there's something so helpful about it in that regard. But in terms of using it to promote myself, you know, it's great that it's there. As a former publicist, I can say, you know, wow, it's so great to have free publicity tools. But it's I have a complicated relationship with it. I don't really like it.
Mm. You know, I have to put in a plug for your cookbook because we haven't said anything about it. And it's kind of hard to talk about a cookbook, I think, on a show about books, I guess. I mean, I don't know why.
Well,
it's
there's tons
hard,
of essays in it. I wouldn't have agreed to do a cookbook if I couldn't have a lot of writing in it. So that's the part I'm kind of more proud of. I can barely follow recipes, or, you know, here's the dark truth. It's like whenever I need a recipe, I just Google. I don't, you know, I do use my own pie cookbook for pie recipes, but otherwise, you know, hey, I just get on the internet. I'm not a big cook. I love baking, but I don't know. Recipes are really not my thing. I like to be more sort of fluid and free form.
Well, I have to say, though, that I, you know, a couple years ago, I bought it on Kindle. And then recently I bought a hard copy because I started thinking, what if the internet goes down someday? I won't
right.
have access to your cookbook. And what if I lose my iPad? What if? And I just love it. And I've been a longtime baker, but I have to say your pie recipes are just wonderful, and the recipes for crust, and just there's so many wonderful, wonderful recipes, as well as the photographs and the way everything's kind of spelled out. I think even for longtime bakers, they're going to get something out of this book. I just love it, I have to say.
Well, thanks. My goal with that whole thing and my whole approach to pie is to keep it simple. You know, this world is so complicated, and all these people, these food shows, they're all trying to outdo each other and come up with these complex and complicated recipes that are, you know, all these added ingredients that sort of, I go, no, I just want plain old apple pie, like the way our grandmothers made apple pie, right? And where can you even find that anymore? So, and I had so many people say, oh, this tastes just like my grandmother's pie, but I never learned how to make it because she just threw in a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So
mm-hmm.
I wrote the book. Basically, that's how I teach, too. It's like, here's how your grandmother made it. You have to just go by feel and by visuals and you know, pay attention to what's in front of you rather than going so precisely by numbers and measurements, because there's so many variables, you know, in our environment, or like the you know, the brand of flour or butter you use is going to have a different consistency depending on what kind, and wherever you live, maybe the humidity is higher, so that's going to affect your recipe. So these are the things where I just go, you can't follow the rules.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think this applies for all of life. You can't always follow the rules so closely. You have to make it work for you, and you have to pay attention to, like, how is that pie coming together? Is it too much water, or is it not enough water? Well, go feel free to add more water, for God's sake, you know, just because every recipe is telling you you can only add 5 tablespoons and not a drop more. I'm like, that's ridiculous. You know, maybe you need more water. Just do it.
So
I think that's what I am proud of about that book, is giving people permission to, you know, not make a perfect pie and how to fix your mistakes if you have one. You know, there's always, pie is very forgiving, and just to like relax and have fun making it and just be proud that you made something homemade that you can share with others, because it's about the sharing. It's about the taking time to make it and sharing it. And I feel the same way about writing, by the way, you know, like, okay, so there's never going to be a perfect story. There's no such thing as perfection in pie or in writing. So, you know, the point is to share it. And that's what I'm honing in on lately, is how there's so many similarities between writing and pie.
Mm-hmm.
And about sharing it with others to make the world a better place.
Well, there's another book, Writing and Baking.
Maybe. I am actually going to teach a workshop that's called Writing is Like Pie, It's Meant to be Shared.
Uh-huh.
And I'm teaching that in Iowa City in February. So that'll be fun. And that'll include a pie making class. So
excellent.
I will get to, you know, sort of do a test run on this theory that the writing and the pie are very closely related, and that, in fact, one will inform the other, and one getting the confidence in making a crust will maybe give you the confidence to put your work out there, too, in your writing.
Mm. Well, it's been a delight to talk to you again.
Thank you. So, it was fun. I feel just very connected, sitting here on the farm, talking to you in California, wishing I was there.
Yeah, well, I wish you were here, too, but you have a great thing going on back there. So I look.
Yeah, and you'll have to come visit, Barbara.
I know. I do have to.
You can do a remote show for Writers on Writing.
That would be fun. We'll get you hooked up
in Iowa City and come stay on the farm with me.
That would be fun. Thank you so much. And
Thank you.
I will see you on Facebook and see you back out here and see you in Iowa and everywhere else.
Okay. Well, good luck with your next show.
Thanks, Beth.
The doubleheader. Okay.
Bye. That was Beth Howard. Her book is Hausfrau Honeymoon. Check it out. It's another wonderful book by her. I'm going to play some music, and we will be back soon with our next guest. Don't go anywhere.